Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Wanted to jump Table Mountain, so you take the gondola up, about a 2 minute walk, you jump over a viewing platform, sort of viewing point, onto the edge of the cliff, so we gear up, and I got down on one knee and proposed to Eva. She said yes, and we both jumped off the other, and we didn't make it to the landing area that we wanted to make, which was a nice huge rugby field. And then when Eva pulled her parachute, she had line twists, so Eva landed first. And I literally saw a bounce off the ground.
Welcome back. Tim Howell is one of the most experienced base jumpers in the world. He specializes in climbing mountains and then being the first to fly off them in his wingsuit. You're about to hear how he does it and how he minimizes the risk in one of the riskiest professions on the planet. And he's going to tell us about a few of his close calls. But before we get into the episode, Athletic Greens are offering our listeners an exclusive deal when you visit athleticgreens.com/Andy. When you make your first purchase, you get a free 1 year supply of immune supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs. I've been taking AG1 by Athletic Greens for about a year now, and I've never felt better. I take it as soon as I wake up every morning. One scoop contains 75 high quality vitamins, minerals, whole food sourced ingredients, probiotics and adaptogens. Just visit athleticgreens.com/Andy to take ownership of your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Tim, thanks for coming on the show, mate.
Thanks very much for having me, man.
No problem. Where have you been? You've been away, haven't you?
Yeah, just got back home a couple of hours ago, actually. So I've been away in the Algerian Sahara Desert for the last week or so. So literally came back, had a quick wash, and on your show. Thanks very much.
Nice. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for making the effort. What were you doing in the desert?
They've just opened up the area, or pretty much the country, for Brits on a tourist visa or visa on arrival. So made it a little bit easier for us to travel. And I just thought, seeing as not many people have really experienced that country, especially not really for climbing or base jumping, it would be a really good opportunity to take a bunch of guys and explore the desert. So yeah, it was really successful. We found a lot more than we were expecting, to be honest.
What were you actually looking for there? Just mountains to jump off, or?
Pretty much. Yeah, big vertical cliffs, preferably with easy enough access, you know, a little bit of climbing, a little bit of scrambling. That we could navigate, you know, quickly in the mornings to get the best wind conditions. So every day we'd be getting two jumps from cliffs that were, you know, as high as 200 meters straight out of these sand dunes. Just absolute beautiful, stunning location.
So you've done all the jumps already?
Yeah. So we went there, and because it's not a real touristy hotspot, you know, there's not much research that we can do in terms of looking at topography of maps or pictures or Instagram posts or whatever it is. So it was really a bit of a shot in the dark just to go there and see what we could find.
Yeah, because you mentioned how Instagram before, because that's how you find a lot of your places, but
it is
a lot of places are also really remote like this. You can't do your research without actually being on the ground.
Yeah, so I think Vietnam was a good example of that. So I was trying to find the first wingsuit jump in Vietnam. And you can scour sort of Google Earth and things like Fat Maps to try and find elevation differences, try and find sheer cliffs. But obviously it's not super high quality. So, you know, a picture paints 1,000 words, and from a single picture, that's what really started the hunt for me. But then even from a single picture, you can tell it's a sheer cliff, maybe, but you can't really tell how high it is. So there's only so much you can do before booking the plane tickets and heading out there and really finding out for yourself.
How high do they have to be?
The smallest jump I've ever done is 26 meters. but I'm not traveling halfway around the world and hiking for 4 days to jump off a cliff that's 26 meters. So
how did it all start? Like, it was your old man, because he kind of gave you free rein on risk-taking growing up kind of thing, didn't he?
I think that's probably a good way of putting it. I don't have kids myself, but I think it must be quite hard to look at your kid doing something risky, but have confidence in them and give them that confidence as well. You know, at an early age, it was, you know, doing mountain bike jumps. And then I remember my dad let me climb up some scaffolding that was on the house and walk from one chimney to the other, you know, across the rooftop. The type of stuff you don't tell my mum, but my dad was all up for it. I think that gives you a lot of confidence in your own ability, because of course, you know, if you're on a footpath, you could walk across it no problem. So why is it any different that it's, you know, 30 meters up in the air?
So you develop this kind of risk-taking thing, and then part of your story also involves going into the Marines, right?
Yeah. I mean, so I lived in South Africa for 2 years when I finished college.
How was that?
It was wild. It was crazy. You know, all sorts happened. Like, a guy got eaten by a hyena.
Hang on a
minute. on our camp. So we have our own little staff quarters that are out the back. We have a TV room that had this tiny colored TV that was flickering Nigerian soap operas on it that were absolutely awful. The door, the carpenter had put the handle in incorrectly. So the latch on the door, you could push it open, but you had to use the handle to close it. So I remember I was in there one night eating my food, watching the awful TV, and this dog came in the room because it just pushed on the door and it walked in. And I stood up thinking, you know, you're not allowed dogs, you're not allowed pets in this reserve. It's a whole natural ecosystem. You can't introduce any other animals. And I was thinking, we don't have dogs. And I stood up and realized it was a hyena. So spotted hyenas, they don't really hunt, you know, they scavenge. So as soon as I stood up, you know, made a big scene, waved it off, it ran off, like, without a problem, no dramas. But the problem with this guy is he'd been eating meat with his hand. He'd probably been drinking a little bit too much, fell asleep on the sofa. So now he smells of dead meat, cooked meat. He's asleep, not moving. And the hyena came in, took a chunk out of his arm. Then we heard the screaming, and then it got his chest. And with the bite force that the hyenas do, you know, they absolutely crush bones. And bone is actually quite a bit of what they eat. You know, their scat is white and powdery because of the amount of bone they eat. And this guy was, it was toast. And
Jesus.
Yeah, flickering little candle when you went in the room, and there was blood everywhere. So it was pretty rowdy.
And you're 19 years old.
It was a full-on time, you know. Like, there was another guy who was a schizophrenic, part of the team. He woke up one day and decided to shoot his wife and then came after me. I was on my Easter leave at that point, so it was a good job I was out of town. It was wild times.
So he shot his wife and then came after you. What was your involvement in this? What were you up to?
My involvement was he didn't like the young white guy that had the same job as him.
And then you know he was coming after you? Yeah, what happened? Talk me through that.
I think it was my boss or somebody called me and said, where are you? Because he shot his wife. Then he was kind of on the run looking, I think, for me. So he came back to the reserve, and that's when my boss asked me, like, where are you? And then he ended up shooting himself in the back of his car on the reserve. So it was, it was a bit of a mess.
Hectic. I can see why you kind of left and decided to come back to...
Yeah, I mean, it all came together. The recession hit, and Jacob Zuma became president, so it made my visa application process to extend it a little bit harder. And then the whole suicide murder spree thing happened, and I was like, yeah, it's time to head back. And that's what led to the Marines.
And what were you doing in the Marines?
So I ended up in the Mountain Leader branch. So I joined, I did a short tour of Afghan.
Was that when you started the base jumping? I mean, when did the parachuting, when did all this start?
It was kind of hand in hand with the Marines. Like, it's not like the Marines taught me skydiving or climbing or base jumping. I was doing it outside at the same time. and got opportunities to do it within the Marines as well. I remember even during training, which is, you know, 32 weeks of really arduous training. It's the longest basic training in the world for any military. And at the weekends where people would be resting and recovering, I'll be out skydiving or climbing. I took my base rig and my climbing gear pretty much on every tour or deployment I went on, and tried to jump and climb my way around the world every time I went on a nice trip that the Marines provided me with.
How did they complement each other, the Marines and then base jumping, like mentally or through habit?
Yeah.
Are there similarities, like tangible
for
things
sure
that cross over?
Yeah, I think for me, especially for mountaineering, in the Marines, there were some tough times during training and deployments and stuff, and you really push yourself mentally and physically. And it was kind of, it swung backwards and forwards. You know, I'd do some sort of training in the Marines, and that was the hardest thing I ever did. And then I'd climb the north face of the Eiger, and that was the hardest thing. And then I did another bit of training, and I did this mountain. It was kind of playing off my civilian hobby lifestyle with my Marine career. But I think the main thing that I took away with it is the mental robustness, knowing that if I got stuck in the mountains and times got tough, that I could rough it through and get through the other end just through, you know, a bit of resilience. And there were a few times that I look back at now. There was a climb that we did on the north face of the Drew, and we got stuck in a storm, and we had to abseil 800 meters in this rainstorm and thunderstorm. Our gear was buzzing because of the electricity in the air. You know, the hairs on the back of your...
Oh, what, the electricity was running through...
Yeah.
Your gear.
Yeah, I mean, it was literally like humming. You could feel the electricity, and obviously we got all this wet rope and metal work, all the cams and carabiners and stuff, and you could feel...
And it's just coming from the weather.
The humming. Yeah, yeah. So it took us something like 12 hours in a rainstorm to abseil off this cliff, and it was 12 hours of just misery until we got back to the mountain hut.
Let's talk about base jumping, because I didn't realize it until I started researching that it's a base is an acronym. I thought it just meant jumping off a base of something.
It's an acronym for building, antenna, span, and earth. Span being something that spans a distance, like a bridge, and earth being something natural, normally a cliff.
I mean, it all freaks me out, but antennas is the one that really...
One of those.
Yeah, so like you climb up an antenna, like a radio mast.
There's a big one in the UK. There's 1,000-footers all over the place. But we did a 1,000-footer in the UK. And it's just around the height where a wingsuit would kind of work.
Whereabouts was it?
You know, probably shouldn't say.
Oh, can you not say?
In the Midlands. In the Midlands somewhere.
Okay.
Well, we want to make sure that people can do it again and again, you know?
Oh, so you don't want to say so they don't put up blockers for other people to be able to go and do it.
Yeah, for me, I mean, there's quite a bit of ethics to base jumping. And the more we can continue doing it and help other people do it, that's only a good thing. Whereas you see a lot of like urban explorers will climb these sort of things and put a flag up and sell their story to the Daily Mail. And then it all gets shut down and nobody else can do that activity. Like, it's just... Yeah, it's a bit selfish, I think, maybe. Whereas if you knew that every day that there's good wind in London, there will be somebody base jumping, but they won't post it.
Really? Know? Is that right?
For sure, for sure. There's a huge amount of base jumpers in London, and if the winds are good, they're going to be out.
No way. I've never seen one.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Where would I... But not in the city.
Yeah.
No. What about
every big building that you've looked at has probably been jumped?
Ridiculous. So someone's jumped off the Shard.
Someone's jumped. My friends jumped off the Shard. Two guys I know have jumped off the Shard.
And did they not get arrested?
No, because they don't sell it to the Daily Mail.
That's awesome. And what about police?
The police in the UK, it's not a criminal offence. It's a civil offence. So the owners of the building have to take you to court, which happens with urban explorers quite a bit. And I've had a friend of mine go to jail because he climbed a building that had an injunction on that specific building. But the times that I've bumped into police, they were cool because they thought I was a burglar. And as soon as I tell them, I'm sorry, I was base jumping, they don't care about the call anymore. They're now like, oh, where did you land? How high was it? How high does it need to be? What's your lowest? What's your highest? And that, they're not interested.
British police, they must be some of the best police going around when it comes to base jumping.
Well, compared to America, where, you know, in a national park in America, in Yosemite, you land. A friend of mine landed in a tree, had to get the fire brigade to come out, took him down off the tree. As soon as his feet were on the ground, the police had handcuffs on him. And this is in Yosemite, where people are climbing 3,000 foot big walls, you know, and that's fine. It's fine to solo those big walls, but you can't jump off them.
Do you do the urban stuff in London? Did you do it in the evening?
It's always at night. It's nearly always at night, especially like the more high profile things.
Oh, tell me about the antenna. Sorry, I took you off track.
Sorry, the antenna. Yeah, so there's a few motion detectors and you figure out where they are and bypass them and start this horrible 300 meter long ladder climb. The ladder's internal and takes a while, especially when you've got a big, you know, rig on your back. So you've got to stay real close to the ladder so you can get through the hatches. So we start climbing. We know it's going to take us about an hour or so to do the climb. So an hour before sunrise, start climbing in the pitch black. And then when you start gearing up, the sun's popping up. I had my wingsuit on for that one. And then the 1,000 footers have guidelines. So the top has a cable, three cables going down at 120 degrees between each one. So you jump in between them and fly out and open the parachute and land in the big field and then run
off.
Too
easy. And then run off.
quick stash in your gear and then run back to the car.
From the outside, it looks like you guys just rock up at an antenna, rock up at a bridge, whatever it is. But there's all sorts of calculations and stuff that go into this. It's not, you're not just finding something that's a certain height and then just jumping off it and wingsuiting or jumping off it and opening your parachute, are you? Can you talk me through that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the most, I suppose, complicated thing to do would be to find a cliff that's never been jumped before and jump it in the wingsuit. Because in a wingsuit, you're traveling quite a far distance. And the cliff doesn't have to be vertical in a wingsuit. It can have ledges because as you jump in the wingsuit, you're gaining distance away from the cliff. So it doesn't need to be vertical. So there's a lot of trigonometry that goes into it. Then you need to calculate your glide ratio, how high you want to pull your parachute, and the fall in your wingsuit before you reach a glide ratio. Because your wingsuit falls, it pressurizes, and then it starts flying. So there's all those calculations to make to just figure out how far you can fly to a certain landing area. Because you might be flying above fields where you can land anywhere, but also you might be flying on a glacier where there's only certain parts of that glacier you can land on. Or in Vietnam, there were certain rice fields amongst jungle and rivers. There's a lot of calculations that go into it.
When you've done that much research and you've traveled that far, do you ever say, nah, not for me today. I'm not jumping there.
Yeah. So the probably the most effort that I've gone to get a jump and not being able to jump was the Matterhorn. So it took me eight hours.
Just explain what the Matterhorn is.
So the Matterhorn is the mountain on the Toblerone. It's a 4,000 meter mountain in the Swiss Alps. It's actually on the border between Italy and Switzerland. And people normally take 2 days to climb it. So you stay at a hut and then go up the next day to the summit and then back down. And the hut's really expensive and normally overbooked. So we didn't really have that option because you can't really decide these things in advance. You look at the weather and you think tomorrow the wind at altitude, 4,000 meters altitude, is really good. So tomorrow I have an opportunity. So you can't really book in advance to get these mountain huts. So because of that, we had to go from the valley floor. So we climbed from the valley floor up to the summit in one push. And then when we got to the summit, the wind was just howling. And we straight away said, not for us, you know. And we've taken all the gear that we need to climb, as well as obviously our wingsuit and parachute. So it's a lot more hard going because of all this extra weight. And we, yeah, we started the hike back down, and then two of our friends had popped up from the Swiss side and were about to jump as well. And they jumped. But I think it's really important for me to be able to say, you know, it's my choice, it's my decision, I'm not going to get coerced by, not that they were coercing me or pushing me to jump, but just because they are jumping doesn't mean I should jump. And the decision should be coming from the individual, not some sort of herd mentality of, oh, they did it, I should do it. So yeah, we decided to hike back down. So it was a long day.
Do you get lots of people just rocking up with zero experience and just giving it a crack and having accidents?
It does happen.
Does it?
You can always jump once and then you might not get another chance to jump again.
That's heavy.
And that happened, I think, twice in 1 year, a couple of years ago. It was a guy who bought the biggest wingsuit you can. And the bigger the wingsuit, the more experience you need to be able to fly it. And he decided to give it a go without any knowledge whatsoever or training or anything. And yeah, spiraled out of control. And that was it. So there's a lot more to it. You know, a lot of people, yeah, even without the wingsuit, just say, oh, you just jump off and throw this drogue, they probably call it. It's not called
spread
drogue.
Your arms.
You throw it and it's spread your arms and jobs are good. But it's crazy how much body awareness and symmetry and experience you need for this sort of thing.
Okay, so talk me through what's going on, what you're doing. So you've let's just say you've jumped off, you're airborne. Okay, you spread your arms. Now what? He's just trying to balance
Yeah. So I mean, it's really intuitive once you've got the experience. You come to me, you go, I want a wingsuit base jump.
Yeah.
So the process you would need to do is do, and this is minimum. This is like sort of recommended. This isn't like what a lot of people do. A lot of people do way more. So 200 skydives. So 200 skydives took me 2 years. You could do it in a year, but 200 skydives kind of minimum. Then you can start base jumping. Then at the same time, you might continue your skydiving and do 200 more wingsuit skydives. Then at the same time, maybe you're getting a couple of hundred base jumping without the wingsuit. Right. Then once you've got a couple of hundred wingsuit skydives, you can maybe do a wingsuit base jump in the smallest suit possible. You know, because the smallest suit is very forgiving. Then maybe after a couple of seasons, or each season, you might have done 50 wingsuit base jumps, and you do another 100 wingsuit skydives in a bigger suit, and a bigger suit, and a bigger suit, and then you take that experience to base jumping. So by now, maybe you've got 500-600 skydives and a couple of hundred base jumps. Some of them are wingsuit base jumps. And now you can put on the biggest base jumping wingsuit to do more technical wingsuiting, but in the base jumping environment.
Let's say I was that guy that hadn't had any experience. Let's say I was about to do a wingsuit. It could be out of a plane or whatever. I'm wingsuiting. What am I doing with my arms? Like, what am I thinking about? Is it just all intuitive, or was there advice that you'd give me on saying, okay, Andy, this is what you're going to feel. This is where all the pressure is going to come from. Make sure you keep your arms at this point.
So the important parts for a wingsuit base jump are really the exit and the pull. The flight is
so the exit is
very
when you're running off and jumping, or when you're jumping.
Yeah,
off,
no running. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no running in a wingsuit, of course. Yeah,
that's something you can't practice in the plane, because the plane's always got a forward movement. You jump out of the plane, and because of the airspeed, your wingsuit inflates straight away. Whereas with a base jump, you're jumping into dead air. That air's not moving, so it's a very different process. So you can't well, the only way you can really simulate that is safely is from a hot air balloon, because you got that dead air, but you've got a huge amount of height and no cliff that you could hit.
Okay, so you've jumped, you're jumping off. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, so the jump is quite specific itself. You know, I jump with the right foot forward, left foot trailing, and that to me, because I jump a lot in the Alps, high altitude, snow and ice, it means that if my right foot slips, I've got traction with my left, Whereas if I've got both feet on the exit at the same point, they could both slip and now I'm in trouble. So I put my right foot forward. I'm looking at about 45 degrees down. I'm crouching. My arms are in.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I jump off and I start to feel the suit inflate. So it starts to pressurize. We've got inlets and the air goes in the inlets and literally inflates the suit like a Michelin man, like a, you know, a blow up mattress. And at that point, I'm rolling my shoulders, creating a leading edge, keeping pressure on my toes, putting my legs apart, keeping pressure on the wingsuit, you know, really spreading it out, keeping it tight. And then the flight, as I say, is really intuitive. It's, you know, I want to go over there. I'm going to start leaning there, using my legs and my arms to direct me. And that comes from those hundreds of skydives prior, where you really start to feel how the suit flies.
Is that bit a little bit like surfing? You're kind of leaning or looking and you kind of feel that?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, there's a lot to use, you know, where your chin is, where your chest is, where your arms are, whether they're by your side or back. Your angle of attack, there's a lot to it. Yeah, then it comes down to your pull. So the pull is, a lot of people might think you land in the wingsuit, but you flare the wingsuit, you kill off some speed, then you pull your pilot chute, which is connected to a parachute.
So by flaring the wingsuit, you mean like flare it towards
you're,
the wing.
You're increasing your glide ratio.
Like a plane landing almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that just means that your parachute's going to open nice and softly and you know, not slam you. And then, yeah, you unzip your arms and your legs, get the toggles.
So you unzip the kind of the webbed bit in between your arms and your legs.
Yeah, that's it.
And then go.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a clip on YouTube that I found when I was doing some research for this. It's titled The First Wingsuit Flight from Highest Mountain in the Southern Hemisphere. When I'm watching that,
yeah,
and I'm seeing your little penguin feet inching along the top of this rock, I feel
I felt sick.
I actually felt nauseous watching it. Can you talk me through what's going on in your head, what you're looking at, what you're seeing, and how you're feeling? And just let me inside your head when you're on top of that rock.
So that was Aconcagua, which is just below 7,000 meters in altitude. It's the highest mountain outside of the Himalaya and the highest in South America.
And you've climbed up there.
So yeah, we've got to camp 2, which is 1,000 meters below the summit. And camp 2 was very close to this big cliff band. So I thought this might be a great opportunity for me to be the first person to wingsuit from this mountain. Before I jumped, my wife said, only jump if you're 100% sure. Of all the calculations, of the conditions, of my ability, my skill set, my experience, everything. So when I was walking out on that little rock boardwalk, like I had done all the calculations. I had checked out the landing. I had actually done that walk the day before. So I was sure.
You'd already been up there?
Yeah. So our camp was so close to that area, I could do all the recce, the reconnaissance. And in the military, there's a saying that a recce is never wasted. So if I get a chance to do all those calculations, to stand on that exit point with a rope safely, to visualize the landing, to know even exactly where I'm going to put my feet on that exit point, it means the next day, that's all sure. That's all, you know, in my head, locked in. I can rock up, put my suit on, do the job. Instead of on the day being like, oh, where am I going to put my feet? Where am I going to fly to? What's the landing pattern? What's, you know, so in that video, I know exactly what's happening. I know exactly my plan and all I need to do is carry it out.
I could only see your feet, but you look like you're shitting yourself. I'm just saying.
To be honest, and I see this a lot when I teach base jumpers and stuff. If you rock up at a new exit point, the first couple of minutes, you're shitting yourself. You're worried, you're scared. Then you start to gear up, you know, you take some time packing your pilot chute, gearing up, start to sort of acclimatize, get used to the surroundings. And then when you're on the exit point, my heart's settled and I'm just there to carry out what I know I can do.
So you're up there on that jump day in that video, your feet are shuffling towards the edge.
Yeah.
Are you okay? So you're okay in that space. You're thinking quite clearly.
Exactly 100%. If I was worried, unsure, if my heartbeat was racing 1,000 miles an hour, I wouldn't be there. If I was scared or nervous, you know, there's a little bit of nervousness is healthy. You know, it keeps you sharp. But if you're, you know, if your heart's beating 1,000,000 miles an hour, I should not be there. I should take a step back and evaluate what the fuck I'm doing. So I get to the exit and I normally take a few big deep breaths, you know, really just calm down.
Is that box breathing, like the two in the nose?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Does that work for you? Because I hear that a lot. It comes up a lot.
Yeah, it does. Whether it works or not, whether it's placebo, whatever it is, it's just something for me to focus on. And I think it must get my heart rate down. I've been on jumps before where the person before me jumped, didn't have a good flight or, you know, tripped or something. And had a near miss. You know, and then my heart's beating 1,000,000 miles an hour. And I start to breathing, and now I'm ready. I don't jump when I'm not sure, you know.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about that, how you manage adrenaline. Because once adrenaline's in you, it's in you've got adrenaline in you. You don't just manage it out. Like, how do you manage that situation?
So adrenaline, I would say during that flight. I mean, that was a very special flight for me because that was. Very high altitude, never been done before. It was my personal record for altitude. It had taken us 8 days of climbing to get to that point. So that was probably the most full-on jump for me that I've ever done. But in other cases, there is no adrenaline. It is just focus and you're carrying out what you're there to do. So adrenaline hits when something goes wrong, normally is when your heart starts pounding. And then when you land, you know, when you land, all the emotions hit and you're like, I've done it successfully. And that's when you probably the heart rate goes up again.
When I was researching for this interview, I was watching a program on Netflix. I think it's called Wingman or Wingmen. Proximity jumping. So like guys jumping out together and you see them honing through like valleys and they did one in, is it Chamonix, the French Alps, where they went through under their bridge, through that gap. They went, they were in Brazil and they went under the Christ Redeemer's arm. They were doing all this like gnarly stuff. And there was a couple of close calls, actually. I think the Chamonix one.
There was a close call near a gondola.
Yeah, they almost plowed straight into one. Do you do anything that's remotely similar to that?
So I don't have a lot of wingsuit skydives and proximity flying isn't sustainable. Even for the best wingsuit skydivers in the world, it's been proven that it's not sustainable. So for that to be your niche that you do day in, day out, is only going to end one way. That's the way that I see it. So for me, I'll do a little bit of proximity, a little bit of terrain flying for a flight that I know very well, and I don't need to push it. You know, and then my niche is finding these hard to get to remote jumps around the world. And that's where my skill set from mountaineering and climbing comes in. And that's why maybe other people haven't jumped them or climbed them, because you need that combination of being a capable wingsuiter and a capable climber. But yeah, you know, it's very fun to fly very, very close to things. But you're making your margin for error smaller and smaller.
You had a close call once, I think, was a Beachy Head.
That was a big learning, a big lesson for me.
Talk me through what happened.
So that was probably my second or third year of base jumping. So still a newbie, still not knowing. And there was a big group of us. There was cameras and I decided to do a barrel roll. And I was not capable of doing that. So my parachute came out the wrong way, hit the cliff, kicked off, hit the cliff again. Goodness. the parachute got hung up for a split second. That's probably the worst situation you can have, because the canopy's collapsed and you're hanging from a thread on a cliff. And if something breaks or cuts or whatever, you're just plummeting. And then the rock it was hanging off for this split second cut the canopy. So I was released again, turned it around, landed, hit the ground pretty hard, and walked away. And there was a hole in the canopy that I could have walked through. Like, it ripped a big hole in the canopy. And that for me was a big lesson to learn from, you know, from multiple different things. Ego, peer pressure. Not that there was peer pressure, but there was a group and I put that pressure on myself, and I learned from it, and something like that never happened again. Which probably plays into that story of the Matterhorn, you know, just because somebody else is doing it and just because there are other people there doesn't mean you have to.
Yeah, that's a tough one, isn't it? Especially if there's cameras there, or if there's people watching, there's that expectation that you've committed.
There is, and I see that quite a bit, and there's even been fatalities that I would say are directly related to cameras being there.
Really?
And, you know, that's part of my, I would say, my job, you know, what I've, the career that I've made for myself now is doing this sort of thing for cameras or for sponsors. But I think I've grown to a point where I don't put that pressure on myself, and I'm not going to let anyone put that pressure on me. And I'll only do things that I know I'm sure about.
Your wife base jumps as well, doesn't she?
Yeah. Yeah. She was a skydive instructor at the weekends in Skydive Madrid, and she had about 1,500 skydives at that point, and I was probably a couple of hundred in. And I was learning to wingsuit so I could wingsuit base jump. And I exited the plane. I inflated my wingsuit too early and nearly hit the tail of the plane. So the pilot told Eva, my wife, to go and tell this Englishman off and tell him that he's being an idiot. So that's how it all started.
Tell me the story about Cape Town. Set the scene.
Cape's pretty full on. Last 2 days of the trip, and we wanted to jump Table Mountain. So you take the gondola up, about a 2 minute walk, you jump over a viewing platform, sort of viewing point, onto the edge of the cliff. So we gear up, and I had a friend who was a photographer who was on the viewing platform. And I got down on one knee and proposed to Eva. She said yes, thank goodness.
Congratulations.
And we both jumped off together. So Eva always follows me. We count down 3, 2, 1. I jump, she follows. And because we were trying to fly together, we were limiting the performance and speed.
There was a little bit of headwind. Right?
Yeah, in the wingsuit, yeah. And we didn't make it to the landing area that we wanted to make, which was a nice, huge rugby field.
So what happened? Like, what was?
Because we were flying together, we're kind of slowing down to the lowest slower flyer, and there's a little bit of headwind coming off the sea. So we just didn't have the best performance in the flight. And then when Eva pulled her parachute, she had line twists, which normally isn't a big issue. And it wasn't really then, but it definitely meant we couldn't reach our landing area. So Eva landed first, and she landed downwind. So you always want to land into wind because it slows down your parachute. And I literally saw a bounce off the ground, which I thought would probably hurt a little bit. But she acted as a wind sock for me. I knew that if she's bouncing off the ground landing that way, I'm going to land the opposite direction. I'll have a really nice landing. So
good on her.
Thank you very much for that. Took one for the team there. So I landed next to her, and she was crying.
When you saw her bounce off the deck?
I thought that's not ideal. I saw it from above, and I thought that's going to hurt. You know.
I wasn't
thinking the worst.
You were.
But, you know, sprained ankle, you know. I was, yeah, you know, we do, you have a downwind landing every now and again, and it, you know, it's not the end of the world, but this one did look bad, but, you know, I wasn't thinking anything too serious. And she was crying a little bit, and I thought, again, maybe a sprained ankle. But when I came up, I saw the blood coming out of the zip on the wingsuit. So I opened up the zip, and the skin on her shin flapped down, like, fell off from below the knee down to her ankle, and like the size of my hand. And I said, do not look down here. Don't look. So look back up to where I proposed a couple of minutes before. And I put the flap of skin back up. I could see the bone, so I knew it wasn't an open fracture.
What, you just closed it like a litter box?
Pretty much, just flat that back up. So, and it wasn't bleeding out that much. Like, she was wearing white socks and they had a little bit of blood around the top, but it wasn't bleeding that much. So I said, you know, are you in pain? And she said, you know, I can get to the car and you're not bleeding out. So let's get you back to the car and back and to the hospital. So I wrapped it up. I ripped my shirt into, you know, strands of bandage and strapped it back up. And then would carry a fireman's lifter a couple of hundred meters and then go back to get the bags. And then, you know, the worst part, because I ripped my shirt off my back, got sunburned, didn't I?
Oh.
It was awful.
Oh. Were you okay?
And I made sure Eva, a couple of years later, bought me a new shirt as well, because that was one of my favorite shirts.
And when you went into the hospital, you said, hey, we've both got injuries here. She's got a graze on her leg.
Treat me first. But yeah, and then after, I think it was 2 hours of carrying her back to the car. But I would go and get the bags. I'd come back.
Hang on. So did you have to climb up a mountain or something? We
landed in the middle of nowhere. So we had to get back to the car from where we landed. So yeah, finally got back to the car, got to the ER, straight into surgery. I think it was a couple of hours of surgery.
Terrible. I lost the engagement
ring.
You lost the engagement ring?
Lost the engagement ring, yeah. And we didn't have, there was some sort of get out clause in the insurance because it was a national park or something like that. So we ended up footing the bill. And I said to the photographer, do you mind if we sell this photo to try and make some money back for the hospital bill? And he said, yeah, not a problem. So we got the photo on the front page of the Times. And I didn't want to involve the accident because I never want to promote base jumping in the media as, you know, shock and awe. You know, the photo was, I proposed and now we did this beautiful flight. And they put it on the front page of the Times, and I looked on Google, how much do you get for the front picture of the Times? And it was something like £400. And I thought, oh, okay, well, it's at least a little bit recovered from the bill. And I bought the photographer a bottle of £40 whiskey to say thank you. And then when the invoice came through for the cover photo, it was £14 because it was the South African Times and not the English Times.
Oh, no.
And I realized I just lost out by giving this guy a £40 bottle of whiskey. But we got the photo hanging up somewhere, and it's quite nice.
So you do ski base jumping as well. How's that different from normal base jumping, apart from the fact that you're hooning around on skis?
So it's an amazing feeling. And the difference is, if you're skiing off a cliff at 30 miles an hour, you're not dropping straight away. You're pushing out from the cliff. You're getting hang time, and then you start to fall. So, I mean, it's just incomparable to normal base jumping, where you step off and you're plummeting straight away. So it's pretty special. It's an amazing feeling. And there's not too many people that I would say inspired me to do what I do now. But Shane McConkie was a professional skier that I grew up watching all his films, and he, although he wasn't the first person to ski base, he definitely took it to the big screen and made it, you know, a thing that people were aware of.
There's a documentary on him, isn't there?
There is, phenomenal. What a documentary. What a guy. He died doing a wingsuit ski base, which is just taking things to another level. There's only three people in the world who have ever done a wingsuit ski base. And he died in the Dolomites, off a exit point on Saspordoy that I redid a couple of years ago.
Not on a wingsuit.
Not in the wingsuit. No, I haven't done the wingsuit ski base.
So you're just hooning off a cliff on skis, and then you just like boosh, parachutes up.
Yeah.
But you got a bit of hang time.
You get that hang point. You start falling, and then then you chuck it. And then the landing as well is special, you know, because you can come in at a pretty fast speed and then land on your skis. And it's a cool feeling.
You were skiing recently and someone fell into a crevasse or something, didn't they?
Yeah, Eva, my wife, she's apparently accident prone. And we were doing a ski touring route up a 4,000 meter peak. It was three of us in a line. I was in front. You know, technically, if I'm crossing a crevasse, I should be the one that falls in because I'm the first one over it. And there's a thin layer of snow and ice that covers these crevasses. And these crevasses normally go perpendicular to the glacier. So you never travel on the glacier perpendicular. You travel at an angle, which will mean that if you are crossing a crevasse, you'll limit the amount of time. But it just so happens that this crevasse was at the exact angle on which we were traveling. So we were walking on top of this very thin ice bridge without knowing. And I heard this little yelp behind me, you know, and that was it. And I looked behind and my skis were poking over the edge of the crevasse. And I couldn't see my wife or my friend, Luke. And they were, yeah, gone down this hole. Straight away, I step off the crevasse, make myself an anchor, make sure I'm safe because I can't help if I'm not safe. So that's number one. Then call in rescue. You know, even if they don't, you should always, as I said earlier, you should always be able to get yourself out of these situations. We definitely could have got ourselves out of this situation. But at that point, I couldn't hear them or see them. And, you know, if they're bleeding out or unconscious or whatever, I want rescue there as soon as possible. So while the rescue is doing their thing, it still took them 45 minutes to get them out. I can start doing the rescue myself. So I set up an anchor, chuck down the rope to Luke, who was the first. And at this point, I'm next to the crevasse because I'm safe on the rope on the anchor point. So I can now hear them, but I can't see them.
So you guys are all linked up when this happens by a rope, right?
We weren't. No.
So they've just fallen flat down there by themselves.
They've fallen separately. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And a lot of people do ski tour linked up, but in this case, it's quite possible that if we were all linked up, we all would have been in that hole. But yeah, so I chucked the rope down. I could hear them now. Luke had a dislocated shoulder, had a hole in his neck from the ski pole. And then Eva had pretty much nothing, a little bruise on her leg. But the problem with they were both sandwiched in the crevasse, like stuck. So when I chucked down the rope to start hauling him out with a 3-to-1 pulley system, Luke couldn't even really attach the rope to his harness or get himself out because of his dislocated shoulder. So I now had him safe at least. He couldn't drop any further. And by that time, the helicopter rescue came.
What do your parents think? Like, what are their thoughts towards all of this?
So I think my parents, there was a point where my parents were worried what I was getting up to. But I don't think that was the wingsuiting or the base jumping. I think it was the climb. When I climbed the north face of the Eiger, I think that's the first time I ever saw my dad or heard that my dad was like a little bit worried about what I was doing. But in terms of the wingsuiting side of stuff, I took my parents to seeing Eva and I wingsuiting. And I took them all the way to the exit point. I clipped them on with a harness to an anchor point, and they could watch Eva and I go through the whole process of talking about where we're going to land, the exit count, the angle of attack, the trajectory in which we're going to exit the ramp. And we landed and met up with them, and they kind of said how calm and methodical the whole process was. And I think it really put their minds at rest of, it's not some, you know, stunt where we're all shouting and hollering and full of adrenaline and just charging off mountains. It's a real process.
What's the end goal for you? Like, what is there something you're striving for?
Yeah, I'm working on that now. I think my goal at the moment would be to get the highest altitude wingsuit flight. That's something that I'm starting to look at.
What would that be?
At around 8,000 meters.
That would be jumping out of a plane?
No. So from a cliff, it would be a base jump. But from,
Everest,
possibly something that big.
You're looking at Everest. You're going to be your wingsuit base jumping off Everest.
No, I mean Everest itself doesn't really. I've looked at it quite extensively. It doesn't really have a cliff that's viable. But there's a few other mountains out there that do.
Which ones?
Well, you really start to limit the options when you're jumping at 8,000 meters because there's only 14 mountains that are 8,000 meters. And then when you found one, then you've got to look at the access. So maybe that there's a cliff on that mountain, but can you even access it? So there's maybe four or five that have cliffs, and it's now just a process of trying to figure out whether there's a route up to that point.
Oh, well, good luck for it, mate. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about you and what you're doing and what you're going to be doing?
Cheers, man. Yeah. So Tim Howe Adventure on Instagram, website, and Facebook.
Well, thanks very much for coming on the show, Tim. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. Really appreciate it. It was good chat. Cheers.
And thank you very much for listening. We release episodes every fortnight, so if you want an alert for our next episode when it drops, just hit the follow button on whatever platform you're listening to.